Now, as the companions sat or walked together, they spoke of Gandalf, and all that each had known and seen of him came clear before their minds. As they were healed of hurt and weariness of body, the grief of their loss grew more keen. Often they heard nearby elvish voices singing and knew that they were making songs of lamentation for his fall. But they caught his name, for they caught his name, among the sweet, sad words that they could not understand. Mithrandir, Mithrandir, sang the elves. Welcome to a sacred fellowship where we are reading The Hobbit and Lord of the Rings using sacred practices. We are using these texts to learn, to reflect on our lives, and to think about life's big questions. We believe that through treating The Hobbit and Lord of the Rings as sacred, we will learn to treat one another as sacred. Hello, Catherine.
Hello, Lorianne. Welcome to your domain. This is the most you chapter we could possibly think of.
Just about.
But this is episode 41, where your hosts, Catherine Olsen and Lorianne Schwenk, will be discussing the seventh chapter in the Journey of the Nine Companions, The Mirror of Galadriel, through the theme of a perspective. Take a seat on the talon.
I never come up with anything. On the talon. Very good.
Yes, or settle in your car seat and join us. Reading in community is an essential part of what it means for us to teach as a text as sacred, and we're glad here to continue building community with us. And I just thought of a better thing of take a seat on it. You should take a seat at Celeborn's side.
Okay.
In the style of Frodo. Please,
yes. So that's how we say his name, with the hard C?
Yes.
Okay. Celeborn. Celeborn. So take a seat at Celeborn's side. So thank you, Catherine, for coming up with that. I just left a bunch of X's in the script and forgot about it.
It's
and there
okay.
wasn't
we all
something
have
obvious, but there we are. We figured that out. So do you have a dungeon or a tower to start us out this week?
Well, my dungeon is that I am finally over both my migraine and my stomach issues that I was having last week. But on the other hand, I'm about to start a new schedule for work and I'm worried that it won't be a good idea. But either way, I will find out tomorrow. And
wait,
my tower
who asked
is
for this schedule change?
Me. Yes, it's a misery of my own doing. But on the other hand, I just laced up a brand new pair of shoes that I got in the mail today, and they are covered in quarter notes, and they say music is my favorite hiding place.
Oh, that's wonderful. That's wonderful. Mm-hmm.
That's how nice. About you?
So my tower, I almost never start with the tower because I like to end on a high note. My tower is that I do have a family member, not necessarily related to me, but that's neither here nor there. This is the 21st century. He's a family family member and a nephew, and he will be turning 9. And what was fun is that his grandmother thought he would not be interested in The Hobbit because he plays a lot of Minecraft. So I posted the question, would a 9-year-old who plays Minecraft like The Hobbit? And the response was fantastic. The book has been ordered. And I was trying to explain to his grandmother that there would be no Minecraft without Tolkien and his fantasy and his imagination. So I'm very excited to do this. And then just realize that my stepsister, her birthday is the end of March, so it really is a present for the both of them, because hopefully it is something they will do together. And it will also help to introduce a little bit of the Anglomania that does run through our families. So I'm excited about that. And then my dungeon is that I spent the day weeding through the thicket of emails, and I hate emails. Don't email me. And it's like bindweed or kudzu or something. I think every time you cut it back and you have about 2 minutes to reflect on how nice it is that it's gone, and then boom, it blooms and grows again. So I just know the next time I check my email, there will be way more. So I am dreading the next time I check, because I feel so good that they're all gone. And I know that's no longer even true. But there it is. And that's my perspective on email. And you have a story on perspective because that's our theme this week.
I do. And for a little bit of fun, this is not even my perspective. This is shared with permission from a genuine orc. And I don't say this lightly, but Mark Peterson is a lawyer of my acquaintance who lives in the Salt Lake City area, actually down in Utah County with me. But as so often happens, I know his wife from when I used to be a missionary. And this one day she set out a picture of his new profile page at the BYU Law School, and it mentions that he played a part in Lord of the Rings. And I was going, I met your husband. I can't think of where I saw his face in the Lord of the Rings. And she told me exactly where. And so this is where the story comes from. She sent me last year a series of pictures of them visiting the Hobbiton set in New Zealand, which is where he's from. And he's standing quite tall. He's a very, very sturdy man, and he's very tall and very kind faced, but he's like kind of hulking in the doors of Bag End and that sort of thing. And it's absolutely charming, except you then get the story of what he was saying as he was strolling through Hobbiton, which was, oh, I burned down that section over there, and this is where I marched the hobbits through, because his role was actually in the Mirror of Galadriel scene, where we have the attack on the Shire that Frodo sees, and of course it's Sam's terror of what is going to happen if he doesn't go back. And so, you know, my thought on that perspective is just there is always going to be someone who has a little bit of regret for what they did in a certain situation, which then reminds me of Boromir. But anyway, thanks to Mark for letting me share that story.
That is so cool. You know an orc.
I know an orc, and he is a total teddy bear.
Oh, that is wonderful. Could you, since you are the most recent contributor, would you remind everybody about Second Breakfast?
Yes, Second Breakfast is the next course of our weekly meals of feasting on the words of J.R.R. Tolkien. We each take a turn and we run on a theme. Sometimes it's related to the chapter, sometimes it's related to something else, but you'll have to tune into asacredfellowship.com to find out what it is that week.
Just click on Second Breakfast. And you wrote a wonderful piece for this this week. So I encourage everybody to read and reflect and inwardly digest and then comment and join the conversation. I like that because you can digest food and you can digest thought. So it is our second breakfast, so you can digest it. And then we've got just a short piece from the Gammers this week. There's just a few interesting words. Our theme, of course, perspective, is a mental view, and it can be a visible scene, and then it can also be an interrelationship of a subject and its parts, and it can be a capacity to view things in their true relations. So it is an old word with multiple meanings from the late 14th century. It comes to us from the science of optics. And again, you see spec in there, like spectacle, spectator, things like that. And S-P-E-K is one of those Proto-Indo-European roots for the verb to observe. And then in the 1590s, that's when it entered into the world of art. And as you may know from some art history course you may have taken or some trip to Italy, there was a point when suddenly people could make representations of three dimensions on two dimensional surfaces, and they went to town. Every painting has a hallway. Every painting has some people in the foreground and people in the background. Everybody's got a tree in the foreground and a mountain in the back. It's this explosion of perspective in art, and it's fascinating to see how much fun they had once they were able to do that perspective.
And speak for yourself. I took an entire art course on drawing perspective, and I spent a lot of time having to draw hallways. So that gives me a little bit of flashback.
Ooh, okay. Should I have put in a content warning? Okay, I think we'll survive this one. But And then we've got a few interesting words. We see Fosse, which is, I assume, is how it's spelled, and not just because I'm thinking of the choreographer, Bob Fosse.
But, I'm glad I'm not the only one.
And then I see Robin Williams, Fosse, okay. Martha Graham, Fosse. Please, somebody stop me. Okay. It means
I was going to say you're borrowing the the Prancing Pony podcast. We digress.
And they didn't invent that, so I know they like it, and I think they sell t-shirts with it, but we digress too.
Yes.
They didn't invent that. Okay, we love them
anyway.
Anyway, so a fosse is a moat or a ditch or a trench, the Gammers say that's from a late 13th century Roman road, which was called the Fossway, and because it had a ditch on either side, and it is related to fossils. So it's anything mm-hmm. that's been dug up. So I think that's interesting. It seems like this odd word, but there is a modern connection there with fossil. And then it's fun to look at a word and then look at it again. And I saw the word plight mm-hmm. and I thought, oh, let me look this up. And it is obsolete for pledging or engaging or making a solemn promise. Mm-hmm. And you'll sometimes see that in plight your troth to get engaged, to promise to marry someone. And it comes from Old English plintere, maybe, lookout man from the prow of a ship. Hmm. So it is also related to perilous. And it is vulgar from the Latin of a way of folding. So I can't even, but I wonder if maybe if you made a promise or something on paper, perhaps it was folded and sealed. The Gammers are just guessing there. And then my last word from the Gammers, they got really excited about this one. Can you guess?
No.
Adamant.
Ah, yes.
Adamant. So we know of that as being unwilling to change your opinion or your decision, or of being impossible to persuade. So it kind of makes sense that in the Old English, it means a very hard stone. And A in any word like that means not. And then
or
you
without.
Look at damant and you can see diamond perhaps in there, diamant or mm-hmm. things like that. So it is, and daemon would mean to conquer or to tame. Also, there's a Proto-Indo-European root. Can I just say P-I-E?
Use it up and we can make it one of our abbreviations.
We might. Proto-Indo-European root, D-E-M-E means to break a horse. So mm-hmm. A, deem would mean not breaking, not taming. And it has meant a variety of different stones, including gold, white sapphire, I want mm-hmm. some, magnet, steel, emery stone, or diamond. So it has meant a variety of different stones over the course of history. So very excited.
Now I'm curious if the word demand or the root of that also has any ties to the word domain.
I didn't see that. Though there are so many overlaps in words for horse and domain mm-hmm. that's possible. There could be. Yeah. I did not find that in my searching. The Gammers had nothing to say on that. So,
well, one final thing on adamant. I'm uh-huh. curious as a schwank if you know what the subtitle of one of the operettas is.
Oh, no. Oh, which operetta?
Because you mentioned the not changing an opinion or position, there is Princess Ida or Castle Adamant.
Castle Adamant.
Is a story of a woman who is absolutely unchanging in her opinion of the institution of marriage. And so she founds this ladies' college called Castle Adamant.
Oh, I don't know that one. That's a Gilbert and Sullivan.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know it. Okay.
I did it in high school. So that's my one real reason for really knowing it.
And you really know those things when you do them. Right? Mm-hmm. It's a lot. So what about in the chapter? Where did you first see perspective?
Let's see. Where did I first see perspective? I literally have over 20 places that I have marked as.
It's a great theme for this chapter.
So we have in the first page towards the end for me, it is, says, Haldir knocked and spoke, and the gates opened soundlessly. But of guards, Frodo could see no sign. The travelers passed within, and the gates shut behind them. They were in a deep lane between the ends of wall, and passing quickly through it, they entered the city of the trees. No folk could they see nor hear any feet upon the paths, but there were many voices about them. And in the air above, far away upon the hill, they could hear the sound of singing falling from on high, like soft rain upon leaves. And I find it very interesting because we have Frodo, who has been both burdened and gifted with his ability to perceive things that are not visible or audible to the others through his relationship with the ring. But because these things are essentially part of a kind of sacred and set apart world, he's not able to perceive them, but it's not because of his relationship with the ring. It's because of the nature of the elves.
I love that. And I hadn't caught that, but that kind of fits into the previous paragraphs where they talk about, it sounds as if the place is outside of time and space.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not just in the opening, but even when they're leaving, they don't even know how long they've been there. But it feels as though memories are still present. And it just feels as though there's something timeless about the place. So there is a perspective of an eternal now there.
Mm-hmm.
And so... Yes, so fascinating. Yes, wonderful. And I thought just a sweet thing, just a few paragraphs after what you read, it is a long climb for those that are not accustomed to such stairs. And that is literally a perspective on climbing. And that's very thoughtful that Haldir says that, I think.
That actually kind of reminds me of one of the first times I went on a trip with one of my current roommate. I sometimes do not pay attention to whether or not we are walking at the same pace. Mm-hmm. And this is a shortcoming of mine, but I don't think I really realized how stark a shortcoming it was until I went on a trip 12 hours after I had done a serious injury to my ankle. And she literally would get across the street and down an entire block before realizing that I was back there. And so I have never really stopped paying better attention to that. So Heller's idea of this is a difficult or a long climb for those that are not accustomed to such stairs.
Very thoughtful, very, very thoughtful. And then I just want to put a pin in the description of the wide lawn with the fountain shimmering and then spilling into a basin of silver. So I don't know if that's the same thing as the Mirror of Galadriel at the end. I've gone back and forth and read the descriptions, and I don't know if you have any opinion on that.
I have an opinion based on the movies where they have it taking place in a different place, but I don't know if that is simply a variation according to Peter Jackson's vision.
We're going to be asking our fellowship that as well then. So thank you. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
And then we get a little bit more of that out of time and space place here, because it says about Celeborn, all right, I'm getting there, and Galadriel, there was no sign of age upon them unless it was in the depths of their eyes. So they don't show a perspective of their true age, but their eyes see through the perspective of great age.
And that actually reminds me of there are a couple of times when it's remarked of the 10th Doctor in Doctor Who, how can one with such a young face have eyes so old?
I'm right there. Do we you?
Okay, I'm going to. I am not allowed to quote Hamilton for this episode either.
Okay, well, I might, but Galadriel certainly feels like a place where Time Lords might come from.
I think you mean Kharaskaladon, since Galadriel is not a place.
Okay. Oh, yeah, sorry. Lothlorien is the place. Mm-hmm. So, sorry. Okay.
It's fine. Catching up.
All right. And then we get an anchoring in time and space then next, where it is 8 and 30 years of the world outside since Aragorn has been in this land. So I thought that's interesting that they are doing that. And it's very like, you know, sort of treaties or historical documents or gospels or things like that, we'll often say, or when Zadok the priest and Nathan the prophet crowned Solomon king or something like that, it gives you a place and a time so that they are able in this timeless, spaceless place to anchor themselves for the benefit of Aragorn to say, we know you and it's been a while since we've seen you.
And then I really enjoy that it shortly thereafter, namely two paragraphs later, we have welcomed Gimli, son of Glóin. It is long indeed since we saw one of Durin's folks in Cares Galadhon. But today we have broken our long law. May it be a sign that though the world is now dark, better days are at hand, and that friendship shall be renewed between our peoples. Gimli Bloudlow.
That's beautiful. And then even before that, welcome son of Thranduil, too seldom do my kindred journey hither from the north. And did we know before that Legolas was the son of Thranduil?
Well, I don't know that. I can't remember if the name of Thranduil is spoken when they are introducing everyone at the Council of Elrond and many meetings.
I tend to write down everything I can about these relationships, so I don't recall that note, so I don't think so. What chapter is that again? Anyway, so I'm not 100% sure, and I certainly, it wouldn't hurt me to go back. Oh, it's in the second section, of course. Not in the beginning. There we go. Yeah, I don't have that written down, so I do not. It says, oh, it does, son of Thranduil from Mirkwood. So I did know that and forgot. Okay.
All right. It is fine. We are discovering that both of us need to, well, I at least need to keep better notes because you keep notes, you just need to reference them.
I just need to keep read them periodically. But so thank you for all of you who are probably screaming at your iPhones and other devices right now. I got it. I'm caught up there. Yeah, so I love the greetings to all three. So you mentioned the one to Gimli, but I like the introduction to all three. What was next for you?
For me, it is this actual failing of sight that we have from Lady Galadriel saying, Gandalf the Grey set out with the company, but he did not pass the borders of this land. Now tell us where he is, for I much desire to speak with him again. But I cannot see him from afar unless he comes within the fences of Lothlorien. A grey mist is about him, and the ways of his feet and of his mind are hidden from me.
That's so sad. They're aware that he should be there, and she ordinarily could see where he is. But there's a gray mist.
It's kind of a very intuitive, but it's an unspoken grief, but it is an acknowledgement that something is beyond her ability to see things. And since she is a lady of such light and such foresight and intelligence, this is definitely something that causes her some turmoil as a result of the gray mist that is about him.
Right. And then, let's see, what was the next? Oh, I guess the perspective on the Balrog. Of all Elfbanes, says Legolas, the most deadly, save the one who sits in the Dark Tower. And then Gimli refers to it as Durin's Bane. So it just shows they're friends, but they've got this different perspective on this creature. So I found that interesting.
Well, I like that you mentioned them being friends. Of what it kind of called back to me was at the end of the poem about Nimrodel in the last chapter. There's this moment of slight tension between Legolas and Gimli about who exactly they see as awakening or creating this evil that they have just been subjected to. And so I love that Legolas is kind of stating plainly the history, or the stating plainly where the bane of the elves and the Durin's folk are coming from. And so it's an attempt to make sure there is no confusion again.
Right. And he does not continue the kind of bad mouthing of the dwarves. I can't think of a better word for it than that. And It's interesting that for a moment Celeborn regrets allowing Gimli to be there, and then Galadriel reorients his perspective. I like that.
Yes, and the response that she has to Celeborn's regret of allowing the dwarves to pass into, or a dwarf to pass into his land, to, and my section that I kept on quoting last chapter was, needless were none of the deeds of Gandalf in life. Those who followed him knew not his mind and cannot report his full purpose. But however it may be with the guide, the followers are blameless. Do not repent of your welcome to the dwarf. So I love that she is both correcting this idea and she is assuring them that they were not to feel any regret or to feel any remorse for having put their faith in Gandalf.
So well done. In just a few sentences, she does both these things so masterfully and then speaks to Gimli using the dwarf words for places.
Mm-hmm.
And I just love this sentence. Do you want to read it?
Well, which sentence? I have an entire paragraph marked off.
I know. Well, it's probably the end of the paragraph. He looked suddenly into the heart of an enemy and saw their love and understanding. Wonder came into his face, and then he smiled in answer.
Yes.
Wow. He looked into the heart of an enemy and saw their love and understanding.
Mm-hmm.
This is what sacred reading is for. Can I do that?
I know.
That, can I? I'm exhorting myself now. I know we'll do it later. We'll do it later at the end of the chapter, but I need that as a reminder.
No kidding.
I'm really surprised how often I'm identifying with Gimli. I never saw myself as a dwarf.
I'm not surprised at how often I identify with Gimli, because I identified with the company of Thorin Oakenshield in its entirety since the age of 8. So
There we are. And Celeborn does say, I did not know that your plight was so evil. So it can be, as we said, trouble, right? But it also is a promise that you've made. Right. And so which one does he mean?
I think he means primarily the trouble, but the vow that they have taken to undertake this quest to destroy the ring is not evil. It is to do with the nature of evil, but it itself is not something that is evil. So that's the only place where I would tend with the first definition rather than the second.
The more modern definition, yes. Mm-hmm. Okay, and what is next for you?
Oh, it is. Galadriel says, I it was who first summoned the White Council, and if my designs had not gone amiss, it would have been governed by Gandalf the Grey, and then mayhap things would have gone otherwise. But even now there is hope left. I will not give you counsel saying do this or do that. For not in doing or contriving, nor in choosing between this course and another, can I avail, but only in knowing what was and is, and in part what also what shall be. And then it says, do not let your hearts be troubled. Tonight you shall sleep in peace.
Mm-hmm.
That really foreshadows the Mirror of Galadriel scene.
It really does. And when she looks at them searchingly in each turn, she can see their deepest desires. So she is able to get the perspective of each of the 8 who are there. And I think that sentence just before you started there, we have fought the long defeat. That also is mirrored at the end by something she says, and we'll get to that, but that she will remain Galadriel. There's that bit there. That's a really fascinating perspective on things, that we have fought the long defeat. Mm-hmm. And I don't hear hopelessness in it. I hear it as kind of welcoming what is coming, welcoming whatever comes.
Mm-hmm.
But she's got some long view perspective, and it's of a long defeat. And a little later, when she sort of spells out, I think, when they're at the mirror, there's her either or choices are both just terrible.
Mm-hmm.
And not what you might want for someone like her. So it's a really interesting perspective. We have fought the long defeat.
Mm-hmm.
And then interesting, everyone's perspective on what she did when she was looking at them.
Well, I'm going to do a slight diversion because, again, we have a number of places where people do or do not disclose what they had felt or heard. And this is going to go a little bit into my religion, but we have what we call patriarchal blessings, in which a person, we believe, receives revelation from God and communicates it to the person they are blessing. And this is usually done during the teenage years. I myself got it my senior year of high school. And we believe it is personal direction for our lives. It gives us exhortations for what to do with our gifts. And it reveals some of those gifts. And we're always told in the lessons about this, right, that we should keep the nature of the things to ourselves unless we feel prompted by the Spirit to do so. Mm-hmm. And so when I'm seeing all of these people choosing to either conceal or disclose what they felt or what they felt was the message given to them, I feel a little bit of that in this text.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And that's all right. Thank you for sharing that. That's a good example. And there's certainly lots of things like that where you can have something that you get to keep mm-hmm. yourself if you want, and you can share if you want. And then Boromir's perspective just makes me sad. To me, it seemed exceedingly strange. Maybe it was only a test. I should have said that she was tempting us and offering what she pretended to have the power to give. And he won't drop it. He wants people to admit what they saw, even if they say they don't want to share. So it's interesting that this isn't working for him. And then you wonder what she did.
Well, I'm reminded of the line that there is no evil except what men bring with them into this place. And so I'm thinking that one of the evils that is brought there, probably unintentionally, is just this fundamental mistrust. And it is what he will carry with him when he leaves this place.
It said, Aragorn said it before, mm-hmm. was it in the previous chapter or twice in this one? I think it was in the previous chapter. And when Boromir mm-hmm. refused to start to walk into the forest there. And so it makes you wonder if that is a well-known saying about Lothlorien.
I bet it is.
There is in land no evil unless a man bring it hither himself. Mm-hmm. You can almost see that on the bumper stickers or banners hanging from the flats or something like that. And yes, I am at the moment right in the middle of Tom Shippey's essay on evil in Tolkien. And Tolkien has not chosen one definition of evil. And so there's one way of looking at the world, and when there is no evil, bad things happen, but it can always be turned to the good, but there's no actual evil presence. And then there's kind of the dualistic, where there's an evil presence that's just as strong as the good. And he doesn't actually make it clear. I mean, you could see both within the books. And so I see within Boromir, maybe not necessarily evil, but that mistrust which could invite evil or lead to evil or let evil grow somehow. But it's an interesting thing. And we'll talk more about him a little later.
And it reminds me, I had to look up the reference, but it is in the book of Isaiah in the Old Testament, not the New. Woe to those who call evil good and good evil, who put darkness for light and light for darkness, who put bitter for sweet and sweet for bitter. I truly believe the word of God is living. So this idea that it really is something where if you see things in a distorted light, it is something that is going to bring woe upon you.
They'll be distorted for you, right?
Yeah.
Right. Yes. Exactly. I have many thoughts on that, but they have nothing to do with this text. So I will I will not indulge.
Save them for second breakfast.
Maybe a second breakfast, right? I love that Legolas gets some kind of me time with the Galadrim. Mm-hmm. He spends a lot of time with Gimli, but also he spends the nights with the elves. They've spent some time together. And then their perspective shifts on grief. That's the mm-hmm. passage I opened with. And I'm sorry, I stumbled over a word there. It's such a beautiful paragraph. And it's interesting that their perspective, it deepens and grows more keen. It doesn't lighten just because time is passing. And that's okay. That's right. It's absolutely right. It hurts.
Well, I love that we have Legolas, who says that he had not the skill to interpret the songs that they're being sung of Gandalf, because the grief is still too near, a matter for tears and not yet for song. And then there's Frodo, who I don't feel like he's compelled to put things into song, but he can only express his grief in a way that he shares with Bilbo. They both relate Gandalf to that sort of tendency in their own lives.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And he has a simple poem that he writes. And I like how Sam and Frodo have different perspectives on Frodo's poem. Sam likes it and Frodo's not so sure. That is sweet.
I'm glad that Sam has his final interjection of the finest rockets ever seen. They burst in stars of blue and green. Or after thunder, golden showers came falling like a rain of flowers.
And he changes the rhyme scheme.
Mm-hmm. Well, it reminds me profoundly. I sometimes think of Sam as a fairly simple character, but what I see in this paragraph is that he's a little bit more like than I thought Bilbo Baggins at the beginning of chapter one, where Gandalf is saying that I'm glad you remember me, even if it's only for my fireworks.
Right, right. Oh, I think there's great depths to Sam.
Oh, yes.
Oh, yes.
But we're only in book two, and we've got four more books to go.
Right, exactly. But we're going to get a little glimpse, aren't we, mm-hmm. in this very next passage, because Sam and Frodo are walking alone, and Frodo has the perspective that it's time to leave, mm-hmm. or he has that view at any rate. He sees that, and then they discuss elves again, so we get Sam's perspective on elves.
Well, I love where he says, Frodo says, I am content and I don't miss Gandalf's fireworks, but his bushy eyebrows and his quick temper and his voice. You're right, said Sam, and I don't think I'm finding fault. I've often wanted to see a bit of magic like what it tells of in old tales, but I've never heard of a better land than this. It's like being on home and on holiday at the same time, if you understand me. Mm-hmm. I don't want to leave. All the same, I'm beginning to feel that if we've got to go on, then we'd best get it over.
Right. Right, that's his perspective, and I love that. Again, that sort of timelessness of being at home and on holiday. Doesn't want to leave, and he needs to go. So he's actually sitting right in the center of a big and. Mm-hmm. and he can see all in all directions from there. I was gonna say, I've been in the middle of decisions like that where both sides were good and I couldn't do both.
Mm-hmm.
So I like to put the word and, you know, like I want to stay home more and I need to earn money, as opposed to I want to stay home more, but I want to earn more money. So when you put in an and, it's a really interesting place to be. And I like to work with that and. So Sam's in an and right now.
Mm-hmm. Well, it reminds me of a previous part of the chapter where Galadriel says that the quest stands on a knife's edge, and yeah. we're not thinking of it as a razor thin thing, but it's a thing that is easy to deviate to one side or another and lose your footing. And so I feel like his observation that being at home or feeling like he's at home and on a holiday at the same time means that he had better leave this place.
Mm-hmm. Yes, yes. And now we have this whole passage with Galadriel and Sam and Frodo in the mirror.
Mm-hmm.
What do you want to tell us about that first?
Oh, well, first of all, we already referenced the things that were, things that are, things that are yet to be, but mm-hmm. one thing that I absolutely am fascinated with is Frodo's question of what shall we look for and what shall we see? Mm-hmm. Asked Frodo, many things I can command the mirror to reveal, she answered, and to some I can show what they desire to see. But the mirror will also show things unbidden, and those are often stranger and more profitable than things which we wish to behold. What you will see, if you will leave the mirror free to work, I cannot tell, for it shows things that were, and things that are, and things that yet may be, but which it is that he sees, even the wisest cannot always tell.
And I love that. And so that is a different perspective on magic. Mm-hmm. And I really love how Galadriel knows exactly what she can and cannot do, what she can offer, what she cannot offer, what she can see, what she cannot see. I really love that about her so much. And mm-hmm. She just gets greater and greater in my mind the more she tells me what she can't do. And because nobody can promise any of those kinds of answers truly to someone. So she has the true magic of knowing exactly what she can and cannot do. So that's a beautiful perspective, probably from long experience.
Well, it also reminds me, rather jumping back an entire book, basically, I'm going to refer back to Bilbo Baggins standing in the hallway leading into the Lonely Mountain when he describes it as being an extremely difficult thing to do, to be in this place where you could go forward into the unknown or you could go back to safety. Yeah. And so Galadriel is offering this wisdom and this perspective, but knowing that they will have to choose to see something that will trouble them or something that they may not be able to trust or something they may not be able to control.
Yes, yes. And that's an interesting use for mirror as well. Mm-hmm. They are seeing not just a reflection of themselves, but a reflection of choices they could make, a reflection of things that are happening that affect them, et cetera. So this is a fascinating passage.
Mm.
And I'm interested that Sam went first.
Yes.
He normally strikes me as not the one to go first, but he was ready.
Well, I actually have two different questions, both of which are slightly Peverita-like, but what do you think Sam's intention is in going first when he knows it, that it's a uncertain situation or a possibly risky thing to do?
Well, I think he'd been saying to Frodo that he wanted to see some elf magic, and Galadriel mm-hmm. somehow had heard that, knows that, something like that. And so she's offering it to him. So I wonder if in some way he feels like, well, I'm stuck. I'm in this pickle now. So I'm wondering if that's it. And also Frodo has said things that he's content. He's not hungering necessarily for this experience, I think, until after Sam does it. So what do you think of that?
I think there's a lot of what you just said, but also a little bit of Sam's ascendant daring is the way I would put it, but it's a sense of loyalty to Frodo, who he has sworn to be a companion to the foot of Mount Doom if necessary and into the cracks. But he is seeing something as it's better for him to be the one potentially harmed than to see Frodo have further burdens without knowing what they are first.
I love that. That's wonderful. No, I think that's right. And it almost like I had such a ridiculous image. And it's too late now. I'm going to say it. I like the food taster or something. So the loyal companion being the first to try or do something. I like that. That's wonderful.
That is absolutely the right thing to describe it as. It is someone who is tasting the food for the king.
He's the mirror taster. So he's tasting the mirror first. And he sees some awfully frightening things.
Mm-hmm.
Oh my goodness. Frodo, pale and lying fast asleep, a dim passage, endless winding stair. You know, I haven't read these books yet. And then this terrible vision of the Shire. And I think it's just Absolutely fascinating that the most horrible thing is a red brick building. This is just the wrong architecture, and clearly it's standing in, it's a synecdoche for the industrial age and for something that doesn't belong. I can see.
Well, my second question then is, okay, both of these visions that Frodo and James Sam have are temptations to something. What do you see that temptation as?
Well, I see Sam being tempted to go home. Mm-hmm. And I think Frodo, I mean, we haven't talked about what he sees yet. I think he is tempted to give the ring to Galadriel because that's what he tries to do. So I don't know if I have that right. What do you think?
Well, I absolutely think that you're right about what Frodo is compelled to do by the vision that he has in the mirror. The temptation for me with their two completely different visions, but also united in kind of what happens, is that they are tempted by the idea of acting on things that they can't currently control. For Sam, it's I should turn around, go back to the Shire, take things in hand. Frodo sees the Eye of Sauron. He sees it searching for him, and he sees many things. I'm going to read it.
Sure.
Frodo looked into the emptiness. In the black abyss, there appeared a single eye that slowly grew until it filled nearly all the mirror. So terrible was it that Frodo rooted, unable to cry out or to withdraw its gaze. The eye was rimmed with fire, but it was itself glazed, yellow as a cat's, watchful and intent, and the black slit of its pupil opened on a pit, a window into nothing. Then the eye began to rove, searching this way and that, and Frodo knew with certainty and with horror that among the many things that it sought, he himself was one. So his temptation is to take a control of a situation that he does not see as, you know, manageable yet, and is very much what he's facing when he goes to Mordor. And his response to this, I feel like, is being so overwhelmed by this menace and this malice that he is tempted to give the ring into the power of someone who is protected by this ring of adamant, or that is the ring, as we have in the infographic that I put on our Facebook group, and I can share it again elsewhere if we need it, but it says that this is the magic of protection. So I think this is what compels him to offer the ring to Galadriel, is this idea that she is in control of a magic that will protect Middle Earth in the way that he himself feels inadequate to.
Right. And this is when, I mean, when he's talking about what he saw, she says he suspects, but he does not know that she has this ring, the ring of adamant. Do you not see now wherefore your coming is to us the footstep of doom? For if you fail, then we are laid bare to the enemy. Yet if you succeed, then our power is diminished and Lothlorien will fade and the tides of time will sweep it away. Well, that's a nice dilemma. Gee, we either laid bare to the enemy or we'll just fade and go away. And we must depart into the west or dwindle to a rustic folk of dell and cave, slowly to forget and to be forgotten. So that is where she is, and that's her long defeat that she is talking about. There is no door number three with staying the way things are or going back to some remembered great time. It just isn't there. So I don't think Frodo has quite realized that until she tells him this.
That is a really great reading of that section. Good job.
Thank you. I have just loved this chapter so much. Mm-hmm. I think I say that every chapter, but I mean it. So it's, you know, we're not necessarily talking about the theme too much in there, but we're certainly getting perspective. Sam's perspective on his heart being torn in two places, you know, he's going to go the long way home with Frodo. and he'll worry about Mr. Sandyman when he can, but he's going to set that aside. He's going to set that aside. So he does that. Anything else to this chapter?
I do want to just mention the moment in which Galadriel considers the real implications of what it would be if she were to accept Frodo's offer, and then her culminating the result of what she decides. So, and now at last it comes. You will give me the ring freely. In place of the Dark Lord, you will set up a queen, and I shall not be dark, but beautiful and terrible as the morning and the night, fair as the sea and the sun and the snow upon the mountain, dreadful as the storm and the lightning, stronger than the foundations of the earth. All shall love me in despair. Mm. She lifted up her hand, and from the ring that she wore there issued a great light that illuminated her alone and left all else dark. She stood before Frodo, seeming now tall beyond measurement and beautiful beyond enduring, terrible and worshipful. Then she left her hand fall, and the light faded, and suddenly she laughed again, and lo, she was shrunken, a slender elf woman, clad in simple white, whose gentle voice was soft and sad. I pass the test, she said. I will diminish and go into the west and remain Galadriel. And so she has this moment in which she sees all the power that she could have and all the power that she ought not to have. And when she has already considered that it's something that is dangerous for them to be laid bare to the enemy, or it is dangerous for them to fade into obscurity or into rusticness,
yeah,
she realizes that as a result of the power that she does have at this moment, she has to diminish, and that is what will allow her to remain Galadriel, the Lady of Light.
That's a hard perspective, and I imagine one that she took a long time to get to, I think.
Yeah, she's been around a couple of thousand years.
Right. A few ages too, right? Mm-hmm. And then I like her sentence, her line to Frodo, did not Gandalf tell you that the rings give power according to the measure of each possessor? And so it is interesting to wonder what power Frodo has as the possessor of the One Ring right now.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there's Gollum had something, Isildur had something. So it's what is his. And so what perspective does the ring have on Frodo? And how would it operate on him if he wore it more often? But she is very clear. This is one piece of advice where she does not waffle. She's, do not try it. Don't put it on. It would destroy you. So she's very clear there. She doesn't often tell people what to do. Here she does.
Well, when writing our paper and getting feedback from other people, someone asked me if I had considered putting in a little bit about, you know, the ring's influence on Bilbo. And I said, I've actually been keeping a list of the times that the ring exercises some kind of influence over the ring bearer. And so I'm reading this part about, before you could use that power, you would need to become far stronger and to train your will to the domination of others. And every instance in which I see the influence of a ring and it's working against his natural instincts, I see the ring trying to train him to bend his will to the domination of others.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So I think that's really a hint of the end game.
Yes, yes. Speaking of the end game, is that the end of our theme for this chapter?
Let me see. I believe that is a good ending place for it.
All right, very good. Then we can move into our sacred practice. And we are doing sacred imagination again this week. And so I'm going to reread that scene that you just read, but this time I'm going to invite everyone to see yourself into this scene. So you're no longer listening to it for the theme of perspective. You are now in the scene. I'd like to know what you're hearing or feeling or seeing or smelling or tasting, and who are you in this scene? And so I will begin. This is after Frodo has said, you were wise and fearless and fair, Lady Galadriel, I will give you the One Ring. So this is a little few paragraphs after that. And now at last it comes. You will give me the ring freely. In place of the Dark Lord, you will set up a queen, and I shall not be dark, but beautiful and terrible as the morning and the night. Fair as the sea and the sun and the snow upon the mountain, dreadful as the storm and the lightning, stronger than the foundations of the earth. All shall love me and despair. She lifted up her hand, and from the ring that she wore, there issued a great light that illumined her alone and left all else dark. She stood before Frodo, seeming now tall beyond measurement and beautiful beyond enduring, terrible and worshipful. Then she let her hand fall, and the light faded, and suddenly she laughed again. And lo, she was shrunken, a slender elf woman, clad in simple white, whose gentle voice was soft and sad. "I passed the test," she said. "I will diminish and go into the West and remain Galadriel." So this time hearing it, who were you in this passage?
I was oddly Sam in this passage. Mm-hmm. And part of it is that in the movie version, they don't actually include Sam in this scene. And I see Sam as this person of little significance in the wider world, but also a person of no perceivable power, looking between the two examples of power that can be bestowed and feeling relief that while Galadriel is power, the ring is in the hands of someone who will never have that measure of power.
Mm.
What about you?
I was Frodo, and trying to endure this change. And so similar to Gandalf, it seems as if she can change shape or appearance, or at least change her effect on others.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that it sounds horrifying and terrifying. And I think he already knows he cannot give her the ring, just seeing that even if she is beautiful and beautiful beyond enduring and terrible and worshipful, I think that is too much. That is too much. It is too transcendent in the sense of being far off. And so I see him, I felt incredibly small, And I think I still felt kind of cold and kind of clammy after what I saw. And part of me is still seeing the eye in my mind's eye while she is transforming into this terrible thing. And so I think it is just emphasizing for me / Frodo more and more how there's really no option but to destroy this thing. Makes it very clear. So I don't know if that makes sense, but that's kind of what happened to me.
So I think we next have our exhortations for characters. Would you like to start us?
What did I say a minute ago? There were a couple of things. Well, there's look into the heart of an enemy and find their love and understanding. I would love this entire species to try that, humans, all of us. And also, like you said, or the Aragorn quote there, there's no evil here except that which comes in. I know people, and again, this will again refer to our faith, even if you and I practice somewhat different strands, we're on the same journey and the same weave. And I am always brokenhearted by people who see what is called the Old Testament as the angry God and all the punishing God and all of that. And it is just like that. There is no anger and no punishment in there unless you are determined to find it. And God is quick, as they describe Gandalf, quick to laugh, quick to anger, but then quick to laughter and forgiveness. And that is the same in the Hebrew Testament. And that's why I prefer to call it that, because it is a complete book for millions and millions of people around the world who don't think of it as their Old Testament. So it is the Hebrew Testament, and it is full of love, full of forgiveness, full of compassion. And it will be there if you're looking for it, in the same way if you assume it is only full of anger and retribution, that's all you will find. So it is, as I teach the text to others, I am always hopeful of that kind of metanoia changing of heart when I teach that particular text to others. And sometimes it works, and sometimes People are convinced. And so I will exhort more folks to be like that. I'll exhort Boromir to trust a little. I will exhort, and then I will exhort myself and all others, because really, what enemy do I have except for the one in the mirror? So if I can look into the heart of my enemy and find some love and understanding, it would make a big difference to me. So I'll exhort everybody to do that. So how about you?
Well, first of all, I want to say thank you for giving the perspective on the Hebrew Bible. I should have said that, and I will change my phrasing of that because it's a much more accurate version. But if anyone ever wants to find a specific place to study that theme of finding something other than the vengeful or angry God, Deuteronomy 4, 29 through 31. Go and read it. It's my favorite set of scripture verses in all of sacred works.
Batter mine but up. My I just read that today. Okay, go ahead.
My exhortation is for all of us, in starting with the fellowship, but the people surrounding the fellowship at this moment, to be as quick to repent of an old perspective as Celeborn is, and to find a way forward in faith.
Great. Oh, I love that. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Now, we're not done yet, but I did want to point out that next week we'll be reading the 8th chapter, Farewell to Lothlorien, from the Journey of the Nine Companions. And our theme is duty. So we will do that. So look forward to that next week. And before we have the notes from the Shire, would you remind everyone how to reach us?
Yes, as always, you can find us at www.asacredfellowship.com. And even better, if you ever need a quick place to find the podcast, you can click on Listen Now on the main page. We're also on Instagram at asacredfellowship and on Twitter at asacredfellows1. And our community group is asacredfellowship on Facebook. Now, we are still trying to do the 9 reviews to have a full fellowship of them, and we are at 6. We're at that number, and it seems to not be budging yet. But when we get to the 9 reviews, we will have a drawing for a Tolkien-authored or Tolkien-related book. We've been reading everything from Tom Shippey to Meditations on Middle Earth to the letters of J.R.R. Tolkien, and we just want to share the love with you as well. So review us at Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. And if you are not on Apple Podcasts, please send us a note at asacredfellowship@gmail.com to tell us where we can find your reviews.
I'll say it again, asacredfellowship@gmail.com. And then we're going to have a note from the Shire, and I'll give a little perspective. We were discussing on the Facebook page about Boromir, and several people posted some names, and there's some discussion, and there was a really passionate a thread of discussion about him by a very young woman who talked about as she was growing older, she was understanding him better. And I'm like, oh my God, I'm twice your age. I still don't get it. And I really loved it. And so I shared that. And then our friend and member of the fellowship wrote back. That was Maren Goodsell. And could you please read her note from the Shire, please?
Gladly. I recently watched the trilogy again and found myself disliking Boromir less than I had in the past. That I saw the nobility in him, and just for a second, and then I remembered that I was, for some reason, supposed to not like him. I have ADHD, and so I have failed more than so in my life than most people. Kids with ADHD receive 20,000 more negative messages by the time they are 12 than neurotypical kids. I wonder now if my strong dislike for Boromir was connected to the strong dislike of myself that I was taught to have. That mistakes are a blight on you as a person, that no matter how sorry you are, you shouldn't have done it in the first place. That mistakes mean you are lazy, that because you fail, it means you are less of a person. I have been unlearning this hatred of myself and working to give myself and others more grace, more compassion. Perhaps my small liking of Boromir is a sign, like the first green seedling pushing through the snow, that I am learning the new lessons I am trying to teach myself.
We love you, Maren. That was beautiful. Mm. Look into your own mirror and your own heart, Maren, and Love and understand yourself. That is a beautiful passage. Thank you. And I'm so new to this journey, and I'd like to get to where you are with Boromir a lot faster. And we're getting to the end of this book, and then we'll watch the movie. So I will not have much more time. So I might have to go back and reread some of his passages before we see the movie, so I can really be ready for the change of my own heart.
And I want to reflect Celeborn and say to Meryn, may it be a sign that the world is now dark, better days are at hand. Thank you for sharing that change in perspective.
Right. Very good. And I think that brings us now to the end.
Oh, sadly, this has been a really good deep dive.
Really fun.
Mm-hmm. But in the meantime, thank you for spending this time with us, and may Elbereth protect you. Be of good hope. Namarie.
Namarie.